Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Laughing Place podcast. We're recording on November 29th, 2017. I am Fanboy. We are joined today by Kyle Burbank.
Hello.
And Alex Reif.
Hello, everybody.
So, we have no very special guest star today because, well, no one was available.
Unfortunately, none of them showed up.
Yeah, that was going through my head, but then I didn't know where to take it from that. So, what we're gonna do is we're gonna talk about Olaf's Frozen Adventure and Coco, and kind of go on a Disney romp.
Ooh, a romp!
A festival of fantasy.
Is everybody wearing their rompers?
I feel like I should be like, and I see you, Johnny, and you, Timmy. And Samantha, stop eating that cookie. You've already had three. So,
what are you doing with that?
Romper room.
Was this a show?
It's an old people thing.
Romper room, not like a national thing. It was like a TV show.
It sounds
like
familiar.
A kids' TV show. I guess it was like franchised to various cities, and then like at the end, the hostess would look through a mirror. And say romper, stomper, bumper, boo. Tell me, tell me, tell me, do. Magic mirror, tell me today. Did all my friends have fun at play? And then she would name children she saw in the magical television land, saying, like, I can see Kathleen and Owen and Julie and Jimmy. And, you know, then, like, the kids would, like, tell them what their names would be, and then the names would be read on air.
Kind of like the E.T. rhyme.
Yeah, in fact, most of the time she would just go, I see you, friend, and friend, and friend.
And friend.
Apparently, just so you know, Alex, the Milwaukee version of Romper Room aired on WISN-TV, Channel 12.
That's their local ABC affiliate. Mm. What years was Romper Room?
Well, it looks like 1953 to 1994.
Okay, well, somehow I missed it. I had cable, I'll say that.
Yeah, I think it was kind of, what would I say? It peaked even before me, and like I just saw kind of, I think I saw reruns.
Mm.
But in any case, not Disney at all. So
I used to be on WISN 12, but I digress.
Really? You're a celebrity.
I was a bit of a local celebrity.
Were you a pop star in Canada?
I was not a pop star in Canada, but I was on a teen news talk show in Milwaukee.
Close enough.
I guess.
How many teen shows in Milwaukee were there?
This was the one and only.
So, for some of you, this is what your holiday Thanksgiving weekend was like. You get to the movie, get your popcorn, your soda, your milk duds or your jujubes or whatever you would have, and you would sit down, and you know then this thing called Nuvi would start, which is basically what replaced First Look, and you would learn all about what
with Maria Menounos.
Yeah, with Maria Menounos. You know, to find out more about giveaways, sweepstakes, and other fun tips, subscribe to her newsletter at mariamenounos.com, and you know, they would show you behind-the-scenes footage of Star Wars The Last Jedi. They would talk about the Google Pixel phone and the Microsoft Surface Book and your local Kia dealer. And then
December to remember.
Not yet. Then you would have, what I would like to call sponsored content, then the movie theater to have something like, you need a job, come work here. And then they would have a little like, welcome to your local theater chain, buy
at
popcorn.
This point, this walkthrough is going to take longer than the short.
Yeah, and then okay. And then you would see trailers for movies such as Incredibles 2 and A Wrinkle in Time,
and actually 10 other ones, because AMC is the worst. They just put on like 25 minutes of trailers.
Were
and
they
so
good trailers?
Here's the secret. If you go see a Disney movie, like, if you haven't watched two Disney trailers yet, then it's not over, because they usually get two at the end of the thing. So you're going to sit through like five previews and be like, now surely it's over. And then you'll get the first Disney trailer if you're lucky. And then, yeah.
It's not over.
Disney trailers. Disney trailers aren't annoying. It's almost like enhanced content. Like, I get upset when I go to a movie and there's no Disney trailer.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying you have to sit through all those other ones first, but that's your tip-off. Once you start getting the Disney ones, then it's closer to showtime.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I mean, we had some great trailers, like for Ferdinand, and a movie about a monkey going to space.
Space Chimps 3?
Rock Dog 2. What's that?
Space Chimps 3?
Space Chimps 3. And, I'm sorry?
Did you say Rock Dog 2?
Rock Dog 2 was greenlit before, like, Rock Dog 1 came to theaters.
Oh.
They had a lot of faith in Rock Dog.
Apparently.
It's funny, when I was in China, they were showing Rock Dog, but it was, like, the Chinese version, so it was, like, overemphasizing, the Chinese version of it. So, like in America, they kind of focused on the rock and roll part, but in China, they definitely focused on the
Shaolin Festival.
Yeah, no, just the sort of Chineseness of it, whatever that means. But
I don't know what that means.
Any case,
great honor through rock and roll.
Yeah, the greatest gift and honor is having rock and roll. But however, I digress. So after seeing two amazing trailers for Disney movies, then it was time for the movie to begin after the short. And when I say short, I mean featurette, which was Olaf's Frozen Adventure, conveniently the same amount of time as a 30-minute TV special without commercials.
21 minutes.
What a coincidence. Isn't that crazy?
I wish it was.
So let's go back. Incredibles 2 trailer. Thoughts?
It's a shortened version of what they showed us about Incredibles 2 at the D23 Expo.
Well, la-di-da. Some of us didn't get to go see the D23 Expo. Mm-hmm. But a lot of Jack-Jack.
Yes.
Almost exclusively.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Then A Wrinkle in Time. So has anyone here read A Wrinkle in Time?
Yes.
I think I was supposed to.
I have not. Yeah, I feel like I was the one kid, like that and Catcher in the Rye. Like somehow I was able to get by being a child and not reading either of those books.
Well, I think that, I mean, I think it was probably actually literally assigned to me. Oh. And I just didn't actually read it.
Wow, Rebel.
I also owned the first Disney produced version of the film on DVD.
Was that like a Wonderful World of Disney thing?
It was, but it was like, I assumed it was Disney, and at the time, you know, because it was on Disney DVD, I didn't really understand that it like Disney lost it with the Miramax. And so it was technically produced by Miramax.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's a little weird, but is the book weird?
Yeah. I mean, it's trippy science fiction.
So what's the whole thing with the bouncing of the balls? Is that like iconic in the books?
What's iconic in the books is the like Stepford Wives neighborhood where everybody does the exact same thing at the exact same time.
Because at Comic-Con they would have those kids bouncing the balls, and they made it seem like something I would understand, but I didn't.
I mean, I wouldn't say it doesn't stick out to me from the books as being something like that stayed with you. But again, it's been a long time since I read the books.
But it looks fun, except Oprah kind of takes you out of the moment.
I remember loving it, like loving the book. I think I started the second one, but for whatever reason didn't finish it.
So then we get to Olaf's Frozen Adventure. And first of all, I got to say, those songs have been stuck in my head nonstop for like a week.
Ding 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 ding. Ding 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 ding.
Happy Mary, Yokai Cherry. Okay. So what do you think, Alex? Because you're the only one other person who saw it.
Oh, I enjoyed Olaf's Frozen Adventure. I'm curious how I would have felt about it had I seen it independently, like Jeremiah got to. Just because after Coco, I felt like it was completely unmemorable. But I enjoyed it for what it was meant to be, a 30-minute ABC TV special.
Yeah, you know, I guess it just it's harmless.
Yeah.
It's not particularly the songs are memorable, but there's some fun gags.
It doesn't have any gravitas
to it. It's not like emotional.
It repeats the same emotional beat from Frozen. Like it just kind of further draws out the whole, like, we spent too much time apart, now we're going to spend as much time together as we can. That's where the warm fuzzies come into play. And so I think it completely hinges on how into Frozen were you in order to fully buy in and enjoy it, which the answer is, if you weren't into Frozen, you're not going to like it. And I think what's happening is there's a lot of what I call frostbite out there, people who have just complete and total animosity towards Frozen. For whatever the reason might be, I think the biggest reason is probably overexposure. And so I think that's part of the issue. But I think people seem to be most angry about is that they didn't know that Frozen was 21 minutes. They may have known that there was an Olaf special before Coco, but they didn't know it was going to be a 20-minute TV special. They thought it was going to be a 7-minute short. And I went with my family, and my brother's girlfriend came along. She hadn't actually even seen Frozen because she's not.
Wait, what?
She's
wait,
not.
Wait, wait,
of,
wait. What?
She's not. She's not like a Disney. A Disney file. So,
why is she joining your family?
Because I'm like a Marilyn Munster in my family. So, most of them are not like me. They enjoy Disney, but not on my level. Few people are on our level. So they, she leaned over to my brother at like the 10-minute mark. I was like, are we in the wrong movie? We were not, but at any rate.
Didn't they, like, know when they talked about this at the expo? Like, weren't they following along? I know they couldn't go, but, like, weren't they reading Laughing Place to learn all this?
No. Oh. It's the same. Like, nobody I actually know in real life, like, follows my work.
This is the problem with America. They just don't spend enough time reading about what's important.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
this is what would fix the world.
So do you think it might have hurt Frozen 2?
I'm curious. I mean, I was already worried about Frozen 2 just in the sense that, I feel like there's enough parents who are like have PTSD over Frozen, just from a never ending fast play experience. And also, it seems like some of the kids who overdid it on Frozen on their own accord also are experiencing some level of frostbite at this point. You know, I mean, too much of anything is bad.
The first thing he learns every couple episodes. 21 minutes into this experience, technically probably more like 50 minutes in after the commercials and the previews. Mm-hmm. It's kind of starting to have to be like, should I go pee right now so I don't have to run out at the end of the movie just in case something at the end of the credits? But you're like, no, wait, I don't want to miss the beginning of Coco. And then Coco begins. So Coco is getting BAFO reviews, right?
Yeah, it's an amazing film.
Jeremiah gave it 5 out of 5 Chupacabras or what was it? Alebrijes.
Alebrijes? Chupacabras.
And 97% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Awesome.
And it's with really... the critics' consensus of Coco's rich visual pleasures are matched by a thoughtful narrative that takes a family-friendly and deeply affecting approach to questions of culture, family, life, and death.
Yes, yeah, I agree with that.
So it also has done gangbusters at the box office, relatively speaking, beating Justice League.
It
beat Justice League in its second weekend. Like, I keep hearing that quote that it's doing amazing. It is, but it's also Pixar's second lowest opening.
It's because it's a 3-day weekend and it opened on a Wednesday. So I know Pixar has had November releases and Thanksgiving releases before, but it is kind of skewed compared to those summer openings.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's fair to look at that. If you look at the 5-day, it puts it higher, and obviously it's not fair to compare 5 days versus 3 days either. But yeah, it really is. It's hard to make a direct comparison between the two.
So there's four movies in the history of Thanksgiving Day weekends that have had bigger box office over the 5-day period, so Coco's number four. Number one is Frozen. Number two is Moana. And number three is Toy Story 2. So obviously Frozen's an anomaly. Toy Story 2 is a sequel. It beat Tangled, The Good Dinosaur, and Enchanted, and A Bug's Life, and 101 Dalmatians, and Back to the Future Part 2.
Wow.
But I'm guessing some of those later ones are, you know, inflation becomes a thing. But I guess Moana, I didn't realize how well Moana did. But, I mean, the fact it did better than Tangled is, for a movie that doesn't have that princess hook,
yeah,
I think is a good start. And did way better than The Good Dinosaur did.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Most things
it
should. Yeah.
So Tangled went on to make $200 million. So, you know, I mean, and this one, it just seems to be a critical darling because, I'm curious to see. I'm just curious, you know, some movies come and go, like The Good Dinosaur. Some, they become successes and stick around forever, like Frozen. So I'm curious to see where in that spectrum it is.
Yeah, I mean, based on what I had learned about Coco early on, I kind of had high hopes that it would become something big, because I feel like it talks about family and death in a way that few films do, and really the closest I can think of to it that touches on these same themes is Lion King, and look at, you know, what that is, and I think part of the reason Lion King is as profound and people connect with it so deeply as they do is because it touches very much on you know, a family member's death and what happens after that. How do you remain connected to them after they're not in this world anymore?
So, you know, I unfortunately knew more about Coco than I probably wish I did going into it. But that being said, I was, you know, in the end, I was very moved, but not, you know, and so it was funny. It had its moments of adventure and it was touching. And, you know, in the end, you can think these things all the way you want, but unlike The Good Dinosaur, where I was moved to leave the theater, you know, I felt you know, if you get those tears in your eyes, it's hard to say it's not a good movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's got a lot going for it. Like, in addition to being a really great story, and it has some really fun characters, there's quite a few, like, you know, laugh-out-loud moments. And then the music is something completely different for Pixar, and it's good music, and people are falling in love with the music.
The Lo-Pi Strike Again.
For their one song.
They only did one song?
They only did Remember Me. The other songs were written by co-director Adrian Molina and Jermaine Franco, she was brought on board as music consultant. That's how she was introduced to us at the press event. But she has co-writing credit. Like, she did the melodies for all of the other songs in the film, and then Adrian Molina did concept and lyrics.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do, I mean, you're, Alex, you're a resident film critic, despite the fact you didn't do the film critic on this one. what was your, if you wrote the review, what would it say?
Put me on the spot. I mean, I think I would have said very much what Jeremiah said. You know, but really, I think it's just that it touches on themes that rarely do you find handled so well, even in cinema geared towards adults. But it's done in such a way that not only is it just profound to the human experience, but it's also wrapping you into Mexican culture, which I think is really important. And obviously, there's in America, there's a lot of politics with that country right now, you know, and so it's kind of beautiful to just put that aside, appreciate you know, the art and the music of the Mexican culture, and kind of forget all the other stuff that's going on for 2 hours.
Two hours and 20 minutes if you include
if you include A Lost Frozen Adventure. So I mean you know, like film should, it's a total escape from your world, but it puts you back into the world in such a way that you feel like you've maybe had your own level of healing in some way. It's kind of a therapeutic film in that regard.
So I need to talk about a film critic. I'm talking to you from the great state of Colorado. The one, the only, I'm sorry, not Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, the Detroit News, Adam Graham. Adam Graham, who gave Coco a rotten score, and also gave Thor Ragnarok a rotten score, despite the fact both films are certified fresh and over 90%.
How has this guy not been fired yet?
He's like the Armand Dwight of our generation.
What did he give Justice League?
Justice League, he gave
5 out of 5.
A rotten.
Oh, okay. Well, so.
So he gave.
So he's not a total contrarian.
No, he's. It looks like he just doesn't like life. Because very rarely will he gives more movies that are fresh from everybody else rottens than gives movies that are rotten freshes. With the exception of My Little Pony, the movie, he gave that a fresh, despite the fact it's only 45%.
What did he give Light Between Oceans?
Let me see if I can find that.
Because that movie was like as un Disney as you can get for being something that was distributed by Walt Disney Pictures.
So I'll look. Do you know what Armand Dwight is doing these days?
No.
So Armand Dwight, like the famous contrarian film critic, he has two jobs. He writes movie reviews for Out Magazine and also the National Review. Which is
yes, I got
which
it.
which is a little interesting, but in any case, I can't find Light Between Oceans. When did Light Between Oceans come out?
August of 2015. No, August 2016.
So last year. Oh, he gave it fresh.
Yeah,
despite the fact it was rotten. So
it's so rotten.
You're on notice, Adam Graham. Despite the fact, you know, it's just movie reviews and not actually anything important.
We got his number now.
Maybe he's just mad about the LA Times.
Maybe
solidarity.
He did say Pete's Dragon was fresh.
It was good.
Yeah. So he He's not like completely anti-Disney. He does give the occasional Disney movie its due, but it is, he definitely, for the last two movies, is not with the consensus.
Interesting.
So we'll see what he says about Star Wars, because, you know, that will matter.
Well, and the thing about Star Wars, kind of tangent, but, you know, even if you look back at what critics said about episodes 2 and 3, they were generally fairly positive. You know, and I don't know if they were just too cautious of being too negative on something that's so beloved and had so much hype. But they really didn't have much negative to say about episode 1, 2, and 3.
Are you an angel?
I
hate sand.
I hate sand. I hate sand after hearing that line. I didn't really think about it much before.
So, I'm going to tell you, like, Star Wars The Last Jedi could get 0%, and it would not matter.
No, it would still make $1 billion.
I mean, maybe in the, like, repeat, like, but if it's everyone loves it, it just no one likes it critically, kind of like the inverse of Mother.
Well, that doesn't matter.
Then, you know, as long as it just, you know, it might affect, like, repeat viewing, but everyone already bought their tickets.
Are you talking Mother, the Debbie Reynolds, Albert Brooks movie?
No, Mother, that movie with
Jennifer Lawrence.
And it's,
okay.
Darren,
this guy's like an F cinema score.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people that really liked it, though.
Well, it's fresh, just no one actually that paid for, liked it.
No, I know, I'm saying, but I have friends that actually liked it.
I didn't see it.
Probably won't see it.
Priorities.
I just didn't know, like, what it's about. And then by the time I tried to get an idea of what it was about, I didn't care anymore.
That's nice.
So, speaking of Coco, it was a little weird when I went to see it and I saw executive produced by John Lasseter.
Well, and on that note, I don't know about your screening, my screening, there was an introduction to the film by the filmmakers. Was that across the board?
Yes. It was Leon Critch, Darla, and
Adrian Molina.
Adrian Molina, yeah.
Oh, you mean like a digital, like on-screen thing?
Yeah. So, like after Olaf, all of a sudden it's Leon Critch, Darla Anderson. It's Darla. Adrian Molina, and they're standing in front of the Luxo lamp outside of Pixar, thanking you for coming to see the film. And then they make a point to say, like, it takes several hundred talented artists, and then they show some like little B-roll shots of people working on Coco to make a film like this, and thank you for coming to see it. And then, you know, they say they hope that you enjoy it. And so that was a little interesting, and I'm curious how quickly that was put together. Because if it was put together following the news of John Lasseter, they really only had like 2 days to get that out. And like, you know, I know digital distribution, they can do that, but it means they had like a day to film and edit this and get it distributed to all theaters across America.
And all, but I mean, that kind of would make sense that they would do that. But then at the same time, you're already there. You've already chosen to buy a ticket. So
I think what they were probably expecting was that if this news affected Coco's box office in any way, that, you know, hopefully those who did go to see it would then talk to people about like, oh, you got to go see it, it's so good. And if they said like, yeah, but it's produced by that creep, then they would say like, no, you don't understand. Like in front of it, they've got the directors who aren't him, and they've shown all the hundreds of artists who made it who aren't him, you know, to kind of get that discussion away. It is weird that like, you know, at the end, he's like the third name that pops up during the credits, but like that would have been hard to change. Plus you can't remove someone's credit just because they did something.
Yeah. You have to, there's a whole like union thing that you would have to go through to do that.
But you know, when you, cause did they do a pre? Was his name on it before, like in opening credits, or did they only do it at the end?
They only did it at the end because there really weren't credits other than the name Coco. There's no, like, there's a prologue, but there's no credits, no names.
Because I got to say, you know, you watch the movie, it was touching. And then when his name pops up, it just kind of hits you in the gut. You know, I mean, not, you know, I don't know the whole story, obviously, about what's going on with him. And I don't want to say either way because I'm not an expert and, you know, I'm not a journalist who did investigations and all that. But, you know, this wave of, and this was before even kind of more details came out, but this wave of uncomfortableness kind of swept over me. And I'm not super mm-hmm. sensitive about anything, but I just, it was like all these stories that you read about in the Hollywood Reporter just became like, it almost, you know, it made me wonder, like every time I see a Pixar movie now, I mean, the ones that he's going to be credited on, you know, I don't know when that will end, but, you know, he's definitely done Toy Story through Coco. You know, is that always going to weird me out a little bit? Is it just that it's fresh? Or is every time I see him, am I going to think, you know, about what happened?
I wouldn't think so, not for the name, but maybe every time you hear Olaf say he likes warm hugs or lots of Hug and Bear comes on screen.
Well, so talking about that, so I was a little surprised that Oh My Disney tweeted out this, like, I guess, would you call it a GIF or, like, video clip? I don't know what it would be called.
It was a GIF, I think.
Of like, it says, you know, these are people that don't like hugs. And it was just, like, clips of Disney villains.
Or no, it was, like, it was when you're not a hugger, and then it was, like, yeah. A montage of, like, villains. I don't remember exactly what it was, but that was the wording, was, like, when you're not
right. A hugger. Yeah. And I'm curious, like, was that all like in the can, ready to go before this happened? It was just weird coincidence.
And it didn't get pulled, even though they had like a week.
Right.
And then, because, you know, it made me think about his legacy. And, you know, there's no question that he's done a lot of, you know, creative, successful things at both Disney Animation and Pixar. That doesn't excuse behavior, but, you know, there's no question he left a mark. But yeah, you're talking about someone who's, if, you know, if he probably put in another 5 years, he would have been one of those, you know, instant Disney legends, buildings named after you, possibly windows on Main Street, you know, it's hard to even think of anyone outside of Walt himself that would have had his name be forever tied to Disney.
Roy.
Well, I you know, someone sure. whose name is not Disney.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, you know, even Michael Eisner has buildings named after him and bars named after him. You know, it would have been one of those things.
John could still have bars named after him.
and it got me thinking, you know, I we all here have been in the presence of John Lasseter, and, you know, he had that persona, and I don't know if that's his real way he was, but, you know, he would talk with weird cadence and he was always excited.
Do you mean?
And you know, he definitely played the part of a big kid, right? You know, you talk about his toys and how excited on opening day he would go. I mean, if you went to this Pixar Short Film Festival over at Epcot, you know, and he's talking about the history of Pixar, it's, you know, he's got this gleam in his eye, right? I mean, he was definitely...
He's got such a childlike enthusiasm, you know, and I do believe that he genuinely is like that. Like, I don't think that's a character he's putting on. Oh. I mean, nobody would decorate their office with floor-to-ceiling toys who isn't actually like that. But
oh, no, and I wouldn't say that he doesn't have childlike glee. I just don't know if his way of talking and that excitement is always on, or if that's just what we see when he...
I mean, I have a feeling it is, because you also, I mean, it's it's like when you hear people talk about Walt, like when people talk about John Lasseter, who have worked with him, you know, they light up thinking about him, you know, not, well, maybe it's only because I've only really seen men talk about him, and they would have a complete opposite experience with him. They would get that side of John that we all have fallen in love with through seeing him speak or just his bonus features. You know, for me, this really like sat in my gut for a week. Like it was weird how much it affected me as a fan. You know, it felt like this kind of dark cloud looming over my Disney fandom. And I think part of the reason I was just trying to evaluate it. I mean, Toy Story came out when I was at like kind of the perfect age of knowing how animation is done. I remember seeing specials on Disney Channel about how Toy Story was made in a computer. John Lasseter was part of that. And so to me, John Lasseter is somebody who actually, in a way, taught me about the world of animation. You know, I got it from Walt and the Nine Old Men through watching Walt Disney and old episodes of Disneyland. But modern day animation, almost everything I know about it, I know from watching Pixar bonus features. And there's, you know, at least for the first, like five or so films that they did, he was on every single one of those. He directed, you know, most of those films, and even, you know, like Finding Nemo or The Incredibles, which he didn't direct. If you watch the bonus features, you're going to find John Lasseter peppered throughout them, you know, talking to you about animation and how cool it is. The other side of it too was I'm a huge Studio Ghibli fan. Like, and the reason that I'm so into those, despite the, you know, I mean, I had experienced Totoro and Kiki's Delivery Service before Disney started releasing them all on DVD. But on those DVDs, John Lasseter did an introduction on each one. It automatically played when you press play on the movie, telling you about his good friend Hayao Miyazaki and the amazing work that he does at Studio Ghibli in Japan, and why you as an American should be interested in this. And I bought into that, you know, like it was more than just, oh, he's the chief creative officer of Disney and Pixar Animation. Like, to me, he was much more of a persona in my Disney fandom. And really, I think for most people, he's one of the few like household names in terms of movers and shakers at the company. That's a huge deal, you know, for your average person who doesn't know all of these, you know, they don't know who Bob Chapek is. They don't know all these heads of development and things like that at Imagineering currently. You know, those kinds of fans or just general public, when they hear that John Lasseter is part of this wave of people who have you know, committed sexual molestation against their coworkers, you know, it's hard to take in. You know, for anybody else,
I would say we don't know.
Well, I mean, maybe molestation is too big of a word, but you know, the details that are coming out are certainly that. Basically, what's kind of becoming known is that this was known. Like, this news would not have been a surprise to you had you been working at Disney or Pixar Animation within the past five or so years or more. And also that potentially other people in the company who could have had the power to do something earlier remained silent. Yeah, and it was, you know, I mean, this is, he's not the first, he's not the last of this wave, but Sarah Silverman has a Hulu series right now called I Love You, America. And in about two episodes ago, she's good friends with Louis C.K., who it's been revealed has done some terrible things. And so she did a monologue, like a cold open, basically just talking about it. And she was like fighting back tears, just trying to get her words out. You know, because to her, Louis C.K. was a dear close friend. And then to learn that he's treated some women this way, you know, was just heartbreaking for her. And, you know, how do you marry those two concepts? And she said something very poetic, which was that, you know, everyone needs to just be prepared, because anybody who's ever been in any position of power is capable of doing these kinds of things. And now that the doors are open and people are talking about it and sharing their experiences, you know, be prepared for your heroes to be part of this and have to marry that. And, you know, she did that, and it was probably a day or two later that the Lassiter news broke. So I wish I had seen it, you know, a day or two before, just to kind of open my mind. But, you know, now that this is out, you know, I mean, you know, we as Disney fans need to sort of be prepared, because any of our other Disney icons or heroes could, you know, potentially be part of this.
You know, here's where I'm disappointed. And I don't know what leaders at Disney knew and didn't know. You know, there's reports, but you know, Disney's been quiet at it, and we've already seen that, you know, the Hollywood Reporter reported something that was inaccurate regarding the situation. So, you know, I don't want to rush to judgment when I really don't have that right. Mm-hmm. But I remember Steve McPherson was head of ABC, and he got terminated for inappropriate behavior in the workplace. And I was proud of Disney for taking someone who is, you know, two steps away from Bob Iger and holding him accountable for his behavior. You know, I mean, once again, I don't know the whole process, but I do believe they, you know, they went through a process to, you know, come up with this answer. And I'm not going to lie and say that if they knew about this behavior of John Lasseter, that it would have been easy to, you know, let him go, because, you know, you really shouldn't be commenting about why you let him go. And, you know, the fans would have been in an uproar if it came out, you know, without the answers. And he also has done, whether you can credit him or not, once he took over Disney Animation, they were reborn. Pixar, for the most part, with, you know, maybe one or two notable exceptions, has been successful in every movie they release. So I get it would have been hard, but if these allegations are true, and if Disney knew about it, I wish Disney had not waited until the Hollywood Reporter was about to write a piece, because, you know, even if it was,
or continued to wait in this case, you know, if right now, as it is, as it stands, as we're recording this on November 30th or 29th, he's still on his 6-month sabbatical, but there hasn't been an announcement that he's actually been fired. So, I mean, I think a lot of people are like, what are you waiting for?
Do you feel that's inevitable?
At this point, yeah, I think I wasn't sure, and I think part of me thinks that maybe the company was waiting to see if things would kind of blow over with the long holiday weekend. But then today you had, I don't know, a Variety, but the Hollywood Reporter and Deadline doing independent stories with more details on more specifics on the accusations, because that was the thing. The first round of articles had like, oh, someone might, no one was on the record, which is a little bit different than some of these other, maybe at least the first wave that took out like Harvey Weinstein and maybe the next few after there. Usually there's a name associated with these, even in the Louis C.K. one. Whereas this, there was no specific names except for Rashida Jones, and she actually denied the acclaim that she had left the project because he had like made a pass at her, but said that, you know, they had fundamental diversity issues or something like that. So,
but
that was the only person on the record. So that in combination with just these very generic things that it was just saying, like, oh, you know, he hugs people, he touches them, and then this one is really more specifics. The articles that came out today, I felt.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one thing that we need to be careful with is we can't lump everybody. There's degrees here, right?
Right.
You know, Harvey Weinstein, where he asks for massages and is naked, you know, invites him into, he's naked in his hotel room, is very different than having hugs that last too long.
Right, but I'm saying like
And
that's
yeah.
not all that
And well,
more came out today.
but so right. So but so when the first story came out and it was like, you know, he hugs people who don't want to be hugged. Well, to me that's coachable, right? That's he doesn't understand the, you know, his understanding of what a hug means might be different than other people in the population. And, you know, obviously he didn't think anything was wrong because he let the Wall Street Journal photo take pictures of him to give him like 45 hugs in a day. So to me, that was like, okay, he needs to take a step back and have an attitude adjustment. But it's not, you know, he's not showing his private business to employees. But then when I read Deadline today, and you read these stories, and once again, you know, can only take them at face value of not being able to be trusted to attend an event without a babysitter, and everybody knows that he can't be trusted with women, and he touches, you know, the touching and kissing, you know, hugs are kind of a gray area, right? Everyone hugs each other. It's just the way it is. But kissing someone on the lips is obviously not okay. You know, that's not a judgment issue. That's just harassment. And so, you know, I think once this news from the Hollywood Reporter came out, I mean, I'm sorry, Deadline.
Well, Hollywood Reporter also had an article today, but I felt like the Deadline one had a
Yeah,
lot more details.
I felt like the Deadline one was. I felt like the Hollywood Reporter was the article they were working on, and then they had to, you know, like, because the Hollywood Reporter one was the one that was in the magazine, not the one that's on the website. So they were like working on this story. He resigns or takes a sabbatical. So they quickly put something up, but they already kind of planned on writing an article. So this is the one they posted. Wasn't a lot new, kind of retread and very broad strokes.
Yeah, actually,
But the
you sent that
Deadline
one to
ones.
me. You just to give show you the inner workings of Laughing Place. You sent that one to me this morning. I'm like, yeah, there's nothing really new in that one. And then you sent me the Deadline one. I'm like, okay, this one I have to write up.
Right. And when I read the Deadline one, I mean, the to me the story about the fairies just kind of hit me in the gut. And I think it just shows you know, somebody toxic. And you know, I hate this idea that, you know, you make mistakes and you lose your job forever. But you know, this isn't a simple mistake. This is crossing a line. And it's interesting, you know, they announced today, the board announced a dividend. And so that means the board is meeting as we speak, or well, not as we speak, it's 8:30 at night Pacific time. But they were meeting. And so you know it's got to come up. And so I'm curious to see if we'll see another shoe drop in the next, you know, couple days, or if they're just going to wait out the sabbatical and then, you know, see where they stand at that point.
I feel like
I
at
think
a
it's going to be a
certain point
liability.
they're gonna, yeah, I think they're gonna come under a lot of pressure, you know, the longer that they, I mean, you know, I guess it sort of depends what else comes out, but you know, the more people hear about it, one of the interesting things is that I feel like the John Lasseter one really hasn't gotten a ton of coverage. Maybe it's just most news outlets assume that a lot of people don't know who he is, but I think they're wrong.
Well, I think it's, you know, I mean, just the way news works is at about the when the first one broke, you had Charlie Rose, who is obviously a much more public figure, and he did far worse things, as
Yeah.
far as we know today. And then on the flip side, when this other thing comes out, you have Matt Lauer, also much more well known, and did far worse things.
And
And
Garrison
so,
Keillor, which we don't
and
really
and.
know about, I don't
And
think.
Gary Secular, nobody knows, and who knows what he did. So I feel like, you know, he shouldn't get as much attention as Charlie Rose. He shouldn't get as much attention as Harvey Weinstein. One, because those guys have bigger names, but also they did far, far, far worse things. That doesn't mean what John did was okay, but it's one thing to, you know, just basically ask for, you know, in the ultimate in intimacy versus being handsy. And n neither is okay, but one is worse. So, you know, I mean, No one's going through this unscathed. I mean, every group, Fox, NBC, CBS, it's everywhere, and which is disturbing, but it's sad that it hit Disney in such a public way, and it's sad that I feel bad for John Lasseter for never not realizing what his mistakes were before, he acted.
Right. That's kind of the other thing about Disney's alleged inaction is that, some of these things maybe they were somewhat addressed if the fact that they're giving him handlers and stuff, he had to know that something was up, but it's almost like if they weren't addressing it with him before, they're doing not only the people who were subjected to this behavior or disservice, but to him to not have the opportunity to correct it. But yeah, as I was formulating that thought, I thought about the handlers and I'm like, yeah, he kind of had to know.
Well, and I forget what source it was or, what publication, but one talked about how there was a couple of years ago, a phone call between Xenia Mukka, who is the head of communications for Disney, John Lasseter, and senior executives at the company. Don't know what that means, but we'll go with it. And they tried to have a conversation about it with them. And the article really didn't say how that went down, but, people don't take feedback when they're that big and that powerful. This is obviously a man who doesn't necessarily know how. I mean, based on my own experience, that what his actions, how that rubs people, and I feel bad. He was. He loved the limelight. There's no question about it. But, he's not a movie star. He's an animation director who got fired from Disney once before and went to Pixar and basically skilled himself into his position. It wasn't a linear path. There was no nepotism. He just made good movies. And Disney felt that they needed his skill to make more good movies.
Well, and I would even argue more than that was, he was kind of a pioneer. He was working in a medium that was not proven, that, very few people actually had faith in.
And not that this is important in any way, but.
And I mean, now it's mainstream.
I think about Disney, the Disney Legend Award. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, this is like, do you let Barry Bonds in the Hall of Fame? Let's say that John gets let go or more comes out, or even if more doesn't come out, he leaves in disgrace. Can Disney even name him a Disney legend? Not that that's a huge deal in the scheme of the universe, but
in the scheme of the universe, no, but it is kind of crazy to think that he might not be. Not to be like, oh, well, I can't believe that this ruined it for him, but oh my gosh, that guy was a lock, and the fact that he's not going to be a Disney legend is just kind of crazy.
I mean, and there's a couple people who I know who probably would have become Disney legends if they behaved themselves and didn't get fired, but to me, he is definitely the most public of people who were, as you say, a lock. There was no question, right? I mean, we would have never thought in a million years, even if he started making bad movies and they let him go, they would have made him a Disney legend as like part of his severance package, which we all know happens. So he was a lock. And now, especially the way we do public legend ceremonies, it's almost like you can't make him a Disney legend because people will boo him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's...
I mean, the only other name that even comes close to me is Michael Eisner.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, which to me, he will be named a Disney legend, eventually, because the edge is worn off, and when you follow him on Twitter, it's like fun old grandpa moments.
Well, and he's producing BoJack Horseman too. Like, it's not a he's not like nobody. I think looks back at him with vitriol.
Well, and I think time heals all wounds, except maybe this one. And
I mean, I will say, I would imagine that 50 years from now, when people are looking back on this era of Disney history, this won't register as a blip, you know. And when they're talking about John Lasseter, this isn't what they're going to talk about. I don't think this is how his legacy will be remembered.
But see, you know, I don't know. I don't know about that, because we're in a phase. Because it's not that he made a mistake, and it's that he is part of this moment in history where women are rightfully starting to speak up about these issues.
Yeah.
And so it's not like he said an off color something, you know, in 1920. I mean, it'd be like being racist during the middle of the civil rights era. You just, you know, he's tied to this now. And mm-hmm. so he will always be on that list of, remember in 2017 when everyone got caught? And it's, you know, so that's what, you know, I just don't know that he will ever be separated from this. If Disney had kind of done the right thing and let him go when this became a problem and just let him leave Dig, because you know what they would have done. They would have said, you know, he's going on to pursue other ventures, which would have been totally baloney, but John would have gone along with it because he didn't want to be known as the guy who got fired. And then, you know, he might have started another little animation studio or whatnot. And, you know, that's what would have happened, because we've seen that happen with plenty of people. But because it's now tied, and then even though he got fired for this thing, he, you know, people wouldn't have really known it. It wouldn't have been tied to it. Even if it came out years later, it wouldn't have the same sting as being part of this movement.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
But on to happier things.
I'll never be happy again.
Anybody watching Runaways? Because I love that show.
I have. I watched the first three, the first day, because I realized that I would need to watch all three for my review. And I was waiting for my wife to catch up to me so that we could watch the new one, and she just finished, so.
I saw the first three as well. I got, you know, the other one waiting in the queue. But, you know, I was, because it's like from the creators of the OC, so I was a little worried it was like Marvel's OC. And it's got, you know, it's got that teenage vibe to it. But to me, the whole story is just, and the characters are fleshed out and the story is fascinating. So it's like one of those shows I can't wait to find out what happens. So.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm definitely enjoying it as well. And my wife actually read at least I don't know if there's multiple runs of it, but she read, you know, the trade paperback of
the first Brian part. K. Vaughan run.
Sure. And yeah, she said that it's been interesting for her because they've changed, like, I guess I'd say a significant amount. Like, there's some basics to it, but just kind of changed the structure of it a bit so that she doesn't think she necessarily, like, ruined it at all. But it's just been, you know, kind of like they've done with the MCU. They kind of use elements, but they also put new twists. So whether you are familiar with the source material or not, there's more to discover.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely – I mean, having read the books, bringing that straight as, like, a – straight adaptation just to TV just wouldn't work. I mean, the fantasy elements are a little fantastic, and the pacing of a comic book is far different than a TV series,
right? Like, I don't think she was talking about that. I think she just meant, like, I guess in the books they're just the only time they really see each other is these, like, meetings between their parents, mm-hmm. whereas in the show they all go to the same high school as well. Right. Or I think it was a high school.
Yeah, and I guess because they drive.
And I think they changed some things as far as
And they fleshed out the parents. Yeah, and they fleshed out the parents a little bit more too, so they're not just comic book villains. You know, there's a little bit more to them.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, especially the second episode, because the first one deals almost exclusively with the kids. And then the second one actually does focus more on the parents, which is, I guess I wasn't quite expecting, but it was surprisingly a good thing. Like, at the end of it, I was like, okay, that actually was way more interesting than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, and it makes me, I mean, I know what happened in the comics. I don't think that's going to happen here. I mean, it just seems different. But so it makes me excited to see the Omazus, but at the same time, kind of get a unique mystery to it. So it's on Hulu streaming now. It is, I would say, PG-13.
Yeah.
It's not like R, like the Marvel series. Like, it's not PG, like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's not R, like Punisher. It's a good PG-13. Occasional swear words and
yeah, they say the S word, so it couldn't be on broadcast, but it could be on like FX or something.
Right. Oh well, it's gonna be an interesting year, huh? Because we also have to figure out who's gonna replace Bob Iger.
I think by the time you hear this, we might already know.
You think?
I don't know. I mean, it's getting a little close. I mean, if they're having that, you know, meeting and stuff, and there's already rumors swirling around this week.
Yeah, but see, that, I mean, I might be proven like a complete idiot, but, and Bob Chapek might be the future CEO of Disney, but one of those, like, clickbait Bloomberg articles doesn't make it, you know, just guessing it's going to be him with no sources, just by saying he's running a division that's successful, is a little bit far-fetched for it to get as much attention as it's gotten.
Yeah, I think he might have leaked that to himself.
Yeah.
But I still think, even without, I still think that there might be discussion about that. Maybe it won't come out this week, but I think they're probably getting close to knowing who that's going to be. But yes, that whole telephone journalism thing where, you know, it starts off with one story and then the next person picks it up and it gets bigger and bigger.
Suddenly we saw the Tokyo Disneyland this morning.
Yeah, and that also included a source that was in a different language and needed translating that I suppose, based on my translation, that they might have been misinterpreting. But of course, if it's on Nerdist, then Disney must have announced that they're building a third gate in Tokyo. When
well, it's not, no it's such thing to was. Announce.
Yeah, that's the first problem. Yes.
But
seriously, their headline said Disney announces third theme park in Tokyo or something like that. It definitely started with Disney announces, and that's not what happened.
I have a question. When you Google Oriental Land Company, what percentage of the time do you actually at least start typing Oriental Trading Company?
For me, 0.
100% of the time.
Well, anyway, thanks everyone for listening. You got anything to add, Kyle?
No, I think I'm good.
Alex?
Nope, I've said my piece.
So join us next time when we will be talking about, well, it depends when we record, but we'll either be talking about Star Wars or the Disney Cruise Line. So we look forward to seeing you next time, and may all your days be Disney days. Ooh.